Tim. I don't know. I don't know if y'all know that. That was like the most bizarre thing that's ever happened in 24 years of being on the road. But I mean, you know, whatever. Y'all do it however y'all do it here. It's good. Good to be with you. I want to start off by apologizing to the people whose hands I shook earlier. I tried to warn some of y'all. I'm contagious, man. I got germs. They don't even know what they are yet. So if y'all have some vitamin C, got some penicillin, got something you can douse yourself in, if you touch me or got close, like, today's the day. Like, you know, tonight could be sort of rough. So, and I'm not telling you this to lower expectations for the quality of my talk, by the way. But, you know, that is a rhetorical device that one can use to make sure you don't expect much. And then whatever I do is going to seem so absolutely incredible by comparison to your now lowered expectations of what a speech through a 100-degree fever actually sounds like. So here we go. It is an honor to be here, obviously, in general, but especially for an event such as this to commemorate Dr. King and Coretta Scott King. And it is a kind of talk that I give every year somewhere in this country for probably the last 30 years, actually, around this time of year. And I have to tell you that as someone who makes my living speaking and does this work as an educator full time, there is only one time of the year that I'm ever at all nervous about giving a talk, because this is what I do. It is my only skill set. So I don't get very nervous about giving speeches, except around this time of year and in regard to a commemoration for Dr. King. And the reason that I get nervous at this particular time is, well, it's twofold. Number one is, of course, it's a huge legacy to try to uphold and to stand in that tradition. And so I'm cognizant of the difficulty of doing it justice and standing in that tradition in a way that brings honor to the individual, and in this case, the two individuals who we are honoring tonight. But I'm especially nervous during MLK commemorations, because I have to tell you, I never really know which Dr. King y'all came to remember. Because even though there was only one Dr. King in actual history, we have a bunch of them in our historical memory. And not all of them are accurate. See, we've taken this man, this radical, this revolutionary, we've stripped him of all radical and revolutionary content. We have made him safe. We have forgotten that the week after he was killed, there was a poll that found he was still the most hated man in America, and the vast majority of white Americans in particular said that he was a more divisive than a uniting figure, which is to say that this secular saint that we remember today, with 50 plus, almost 51 years in the grave, is a very different man than the man that was taken from us on April 4th of 1968. But see, you can sanitize a man a half century after he died, knowing that he cannot rise out of the grave to correct your error. But the rest of us can correct your error as a country, as a society, and I intend to do a little of that tonight, because the Dr. King we recall is the safe one. Several years ago, I remember being in Seattle for an MLK talk, and I opened the paper that morning. I noticed that it had become so sanitized that Sears or JCPenney or one of them was having a Martin Luther King Day sale. Just another opportunity to sell merchandise. Now, I have to be honest, it was sort of funny because it was a white sale, y'all, so that's sort of funny. It's especially funny if y'all know what a white sale means, like that sheet, y'all, so laugh again because it'll catch up with you. I remember thinking to myself how bizarre, right, that we made this man so safe that we sell merchandise. It just becomes another opportunity to sell stuff. That's how we've stripped him of radical and revolutionary content. We do it every year around this time when they show you that one clip from that one speech, the only one they ever want to show you, and the only statement that most people know that the man ever made, the one from the I Have a Dream speech, right, where he says that he looks forward to the day when we judge people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Listen to me when I tell you this, that is the safest, most meaningless statement that the man ever said. It is like an afterthought in that speech. If you listen to the whole speech, that is not what that speech was about. But that's the safe Dr. King. Oh, that makes us feel good. See, there's no dangerous content there. Oh, we should just judge each other on the basis of the content of our character, not the color of our skin. But see, shortly before he said that in that speech, he mentioned that America had bounced a check to black folks. They don't play that part. during King Day commemorations. And they don't even tell you what the name of the march was. You can call it the March on Washington. That's not what it was called, y'all. It was the March for Jobs and Freedom. And one of the demands in the platform of the organizers was that housing should be seen as a human right, not as a commodity that you either can afford or not afford. See, it was a radical economic and political and social vision of racial and economic justice, but we've wrung all of that out of it like water out of a wet towel, because we don't want to talk about that. That's too dangerous. They don't quote Dr. King from April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was killed, when he gave that talk at the Riverside Church uptown in Manhattan, where he said what? He said that although it pained him to acknowledge it, he had to admit that America, his country, your country, my country, this country, had become the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Now, you don't have to agree with Dr. King's assessment, either in 1967 at the height of the Vietnam War or today. But whether you agree with his assessment or don't, you do not have the right to pretend he didn't say it, and then come to commemorations and quote this man and honor this man, but only the parts that are safe and easy and not the parts that make you uncomfortable. See, we can't act like he wasn't who he was. We can't act like white America loved him. See, everybody can tell you they marched with Dr. King. Everybody who says that they marched with Dr. King had actually marched with Dr. King, we wouldn't be having to have this conversation about racism in 2019. Trust that. Just like white folks will tell you they got black friends. We all say that. We're usually lying, y'all. I've been white a long time. I know all the tricks. We say we got black friends, we dated an Asian woman once, we got a dream catcher in our rearview mirror, and now we're Native American, right? Great-great-grandmother was a Cherokee princess. The hell she was, she was not. And even if we actually have black and brown friends, what does it have to do with it? How does that get you out of the charge of racism, y'all? Having black, look, men who are heterosexual, marry, sleep with, and date women, are there no straight sexists in this country? Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think there are any women in this room to be like, well, my husband can't possibly be a sexist because he's married to a woman. You see how that works, right? Like, sleeping with someone is more intimate than just being friends with them, right? So clearly, see, this logic doesn't apply, but we keep saying it because we just don't want to have a real conversation. See, we need to have a real conversation, not the sort of surface level stuff and the stuff that reeks of inadequate historical memory, whether it's about Dr. King or about our country. Because the same mistaken historical memory that so sanitizes Dr. King is the same problematic historical memory that gets us in trouble today politically and is at the root of our divide. See, if you had to come up with one thing that was the source, like if you had to, I know there's never one thing that's the source of our problems, right? There are always multiple causes. But if you had to come up with one thing that is at the root of our current troubles with regard to race, you could do a lot worse than to name stunted historical memory. Because when you do not have an appropriate historical memory, you cannot see the themes and the problems that keep recurring all throughout American history, and you keep trying to reinvent the wheel instead of understanding that we're fighting the same dragons, the same monsters we've always been fighting. After the election in 2016, a lot of folks said, this is unprecedented. My goodness, this isn't normal, right? This is not the America we know. For real, what America y'all been living in? When you say it's unprecedented, what does that mean? Now, I will grant you, rage tweeting at 4:30 in the morning from the Oval Office after 2 hours of sleep and 8 hours of binge watching Fox News is a little weird. That's a little different. Right? That might be unique. But in general, what exactly is unprecedented about this moment? Racial division, is that unprecedented? Right? Hatred, is that unprecedented? A rich white man coming to power telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown, is that some new stuff? Man, that's the oldest playbook in the playbook of American politics. Rich white folks telling not rich white people that their enemies are black and brown, that is literally on the first page of the playbook written in the colonial period. That's what the landowners did to divide European indentured servants from African enslaved persons, right? Made those indentured servants think they were superior, even though they were just one level above slaves themselves, right? But you tell them, oh, you know, you gotta stay away from these people. We're gonna give you just a little bit of privilege. We're gonna give you the right to own land, not much, and only if you're men, right? And we're gonna let you testify in court and enter into contracts. Oh, and we're gonna get rid of indentured servitude. So you'll be free labor now. So you make these landless peasants think they're superior, and then what happens? All of the rebellions that were emerging in the colonial period, Bacon's Rebellion in 1676 as one example, all those start to diminish because now you've created a psychological wage of whiteness that tells these Europeans who didn't even know they were white yet, because that wasn't the term that was used. There were no white people in Europe, right? We didn't call ourselves that. We weren't one big happy family in Europe. Man, if you need to know European history, like, in a nutshell, I mean, I know some of y'all study it for, like, years, but the thumbnail sketch is that the history of Europe is the history of killing each other and looking for the witch, y'all. That's pretty much what we did, right? And so the idea that we were one big happy family, one big team, nonsense, but we created that team to divide and conquer poor people, landless people, peasants, working class people. Rich white people telling not rich white people their enemies are black and brown. Civil War comes around, same thing. Right? The rich in my part, I'm from Tennessee, man. I'm a Southerner born and bred, been there all my life. The rich where I'm from acknowledged that they wanted to break away from the Union to maintain slavery. They didn't give any other reason. Anybody tells you different is lying or a fool. The only reason for the formation of the Confederacy, by the admission of those who created it, was the maintenance of white supremacy and enslavement. Right? They were willing to go to war and to die for that, but the rich didn't want to fight. Rich people don't go to war, right? Rich people get doctors to write phony notes saying they have heel spurs so they don't have to go to war. That's what rich people do. They wanted the poor to fight. How do you get the poor to fight, man? Why in the world, if you were poor in the South, would you go to fight so that I can keep my slaves? That's weird, right? You don't own any. You don't own any land. You're poor. You don't even own the shirt on your back, man, but you're gonna go fight so I can keep my stuff? That's awfully nice of you. Why would you do it? Because the rich came to you and said, oh man, if these black people get free, they're gonna take your job. Ooh. No fool, they already got your job. Right, that's the point. Because if you're white and you have to charge like $1 a day to work on the plantation and they can get the black guy to do it for free because they own him, guess who got the job? Free got the job. So poor white people would have been better off joining with black folk to overthrow the aristocratic arrangements in the South, but rich white folks told not rich white people their enemies are black and brown, and the psychological wage of whiteness trumped, no pun intended, the self-interest. See, some names are appropriate as hell, y'all. Trumped the actual self-interest of the vast majority of so-called white people, and now we see the same thing with immigration. I'll come back to that in a minute.